You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of May 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's program...
I like Hillary, and I've been waiting for her. So we all have, I think.
Well, being Martha Stewart's pick for president is perhaps one indicator for success. But how much weight does the celebrity endorsement factor hold in the race for political power? Ivor Gaber and Oscar Guardiola Rivera join me in the studio with their insights. Also ahead, immigration is emerging as one of the European Union's most delicate balancing acts. And it's one that British Prime Minister David Cameron is having trouble pulling off.
If you have uncontrolled immigration, you have uncontrolled pressure on public services. And that raises basic issues of fairness.
Plus, another Middle Eastern city falls at the hands of ISIS. We'll be discussing all that and more on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University. Oscar and Ivor, thank you both for coming today. A record number of people settled in the United Kingdom last year, more than 640,000, bringing the net migration figure to 318,000. Now, this is a problem for British Prime Minister David Cameron, who promised, no ifs, no buts, that he would reduce that number to the tens of thousands. And the problem for Mr. Cameron is the European Union. Britain can't actually stop people from Germany, France, or perhaps more pertinently, Romania and Bulgaria, from coming to the UK. A referendum on Britain's membership may solve that problem for him, of course. But Ivor Gaber, is this actually a problem for Britain? Surely this shows that we have a strong economy and that we have a strong culture and that people want to come here, and surely that's a good thing.
Well, there's a related story tonight that I saw in London's Evening Standard that that London has three times the average of European standard. You know what I mean? It's three times better to live in London, yes, than elsewhere, yeah, which is obviously one of the major magnets. But I think there's two observations I'd make. Firstly, the figures show that despite, as you say, EU migrants are, I won't say a problem, but part of the issue. Actually, it's immigration from non-EU countries still is larger than immigration from EU countries, although that does include students, and that is, for me speaking as an academic, a real problem, because I don't think students should be included. They're a very different category. However, having said that, it's not immigration for the last 15, 20 years has not been a problem. In terms of the economy, it's been a fantastic boost to the UK economy. It's met labour shortages, skill shortages, and has been a really important factor in UK economic growth. It has been a problem in social terms because migrants go to the same areas, and the squeeze on doctors, hospitals, schools, housing in those areas where they settle is, one cannot get away from it, a problem.
Oscar Guardiola Rivera, on that issue of EU migration not being the problem. The reason I say it like that is because David Cameron and the Conservative government can't do anything about that number. That has meant that they have tried to, wherever possible, put the squeeze on those figures where they can. So we've seen lots of very good, highly skilled people who had visas here have them not renewed. And there's an argument that's used by people in the city, by people in business, people in universities like yourself, that actually this country is now losing a lot of the best and the brightest that it should be wanting to attract.
That is absolutely the case. Let us be clear. Immigration is not a problem. Most immigration is not not a problem. It is very good for the country. Every single figure you use will demonstrate how good it has been for the economy, how good it has been for culture. And it is the case that because the Prime Minister cannot do anything about the EU, they are trying to patch you know, to put a patch where they can, and to use measures that fall upon those who should not be singled out at all. So Britain is losing highly skilled workers. It is also falling on the bad side of the argument on immigration. The argument should be very different. It should not be about criminalizing immigrants. That will not help at all. If anything, it will make things worse, because those who would be persecuted will now find themselves in a situation of near slavery, not being able to keep their earnings.
Ivor Gaber, is there perhaps a slight disconnect here in that for those of us here in London, immigration, most people will think, is a good thing. Many of us will either be immigrants, or we'll work with immigrants, or we'll live next to immigrants, or even with immigrants. And yet, if you venture outside London, where you know people will argue that actually a lot more migrant labour coming in has affected their chances of getting a job, has affected their chance of their kids getting into a good school.
Well, I think it's a very complex issue. I don't think it's as black and white as perhaps Oscar's suggesting, that there are no problems, because there are areas in the country where immigration pinches, where, for example, immigration has, it is reported, depressed wages in eastern England, where there's not huge quantities of migrants, but sufficient to keep down wage levels, according to trade unionists. Now, that's a problem of employers taking advantage of it, but nonetheless,
you said, it pinches. Is that the same as saying that this is the problem?
Well, it is a problem if you're immediately facing it. I do think you have to recognise that Britain has faced a larger sudden increase in people coming to this country than at any time in recent history. In the last 2 years, there's been almost 1 million people have come into this country. And it's not the numbers, it's the speed that is the problem of adjusting British society to those numbers coming.
If that's the case, why don't we change the tune of the argument and we ask ourselves to prepare ourselves better for the increasing number of immigrants that will arrive anyway?
But the issue is that one isn't able to predict the exact flow, and one isn't able to predict where they will go. So society is having to adjust very rapidly to changes. Not again, economically, it's been of net benefit. In terms of schools and hospitals, in the long term, it might be of benefit, but in the short term, unquestionably, in parts of this country, whether it's caused real problems or perceived problems, I think if you look at all the opinion polls, and we won't go into those in any detail, but migration has remained a major concern of British people.
Oscar, do you feel welcomed here as someone who's from Colombia, who's lived in London for many years?
Yes, I do. My daughter is from Wiltshire. My former wife is from Chippenham, so I do feel most welcome. And because of that experience, because of having the experience of knowing very well English people from outside of London, I can tell you that the issue of perceived problem can be tackled. If the problem is perception rather than reality, then we should make that distinction and avoid making the kind of noise that the Prime Minister keeps making. As Lord Green of Migration Watch put it, we need to stop and think where this mass immigration is leading. If there is a possible increase of 3 million in the UK population, we must start preparing ourselves for that intake, rather than denying what is going to happen.
Ivor, there is really no one, though, within mainstream political thinking, certainly in outside of Scotland, where they take a slightly different view on this, that will say, will put forward arguments like that. You have Liberal Democrats, maybe, who will make, and
the Green Party has a very progressive policy on immigration. Yes. Scotland has a labour shortage. I mean, that is why they need immigrants. And UK has labour shortages in certain areas, but it is mainly England that is the recipient of most new migrants.
But it's interesting that, you know, not just the Conservative Party, but the Labour Party as well. And, you know, it's barely a day goes by when we don't hear the dulcet tones of Nigel Farage of UKIP talking about migration as well. Certainly the debate and how it's talked about in this country, Ivor, is there are very few people that are putting forward this argument that actually migration is a positive thing and something that we should celebrate.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks. Politicians are in the business of winning elections, and if all your polls are telling you that immigration is of a major concern, you've got to be a very brave or foolhardy politician to fly in the face of that. We live in a consumer society, and politicians act like any retail firm. They will offer goods which they think are more acceptable to the market, and the market at the moment is saying, up with which we will not put.
And yet we also ask our politicians to show leadership. Well, real leadership in this issue would be paying more attention to grassroots movements, such as the Latino movement here in London, which is organizing itself precisely to open up a reasonable dialogue about all the good things that migrants have brought to this country.
Ivor, we're probably going to have a referendum on Britain's membership of the European Union. It's been promised by the end of 2017. So we're going to have a very, very long time to talk about these issues.
It might well come earlier.
And really, let's hope it does, so we can then start talking about other things. But when it does come, how much do you feel migration is going to play a part in that, considering that 5 years ago, perhaps, that wouldn't have been the major issue?
I agree that it has raised up the political agenda. I think that what we have is, we have a problem of code, because as I said at the beginning of this conversation, actually the biggest groups coming into this country are still non-EU citizen, coming from, to be nostalgic, the Empire, but the Commonwealth or whatever, and they are family link-ups. These are husbands, wives, children, legitimately seeking reunion with their families. Some come as highly skilled workers. But to revert to your question, there is a real problem, but it's going to be a perception one, to reiterate Oscar's words, because the EU, as far as I can see, cannot compromise on the fundamental principle of free movement of labour, but it can adjust benefits, etc. Now, the polls even today are saying, and joined by the Latvians, no, this is going to discriminate against workers from Eastern Europe. But I think the original six, I was just trying to name them, the Benelux, France and Germany in particular, will be sympathetic to adjusting the free movement of labour rules so that benefits can be altered in order to deter.
You mentioned students earlier, Ivor, and both of you, Ivor and Oscar, you know, work at universities. Oscar, do you see this debate already having an impact on both the staff at your university and also the makeup of students? This sort of crackdown on, because as Ivor says, bizarrely, students are included in the numbers. Is that having an impact on the type of people who are coming here?
Absolutely. Being a world-class university means to attract people from all over the world. But I'll tell you the story of a Latin American student who was not allowed to go back to his home country in Latin America before seeking and obtaining permission from a university bureaucrat who was, let's say, being too cautious when it came to the rules and the pressure put upon him by UK border.
Well, I'm not sure they're being cautious. I had a PhD student who wanted to transfer from my previous university to the current one. She went back to Moscow, where she lived, went to British Council and said she was going to change. And he said, well, if you seek to change it, I'll query your status as a student and refuse you a visa. Now, are you sure you want to change?
I was being ironic. I must clarify when I say cautious, overcautious. I mean, these guys, it is a terrible problem. Universities are suffering insofar as we're not being as able as we were before to attract people from elsewhere. But this debate, the fact that it is being conducted in the wrong terms, is also affecting our intellectual and cultural stance as an integrated society.
Let's move on now. If any political candidate lends themselves nicely to the American celebrity machine, it's surely Hillary Clinton. And that machine kicked into gear this week with both Beyonce and the rapper 50 Cent declaring their public enthusiasm for Hillary in 2016. And while it may seem like news more at home in the glossy mag pages, many pundits put a considerable level of weight in the celebrity endorsement factor. Ivor Gaber, how important is it do you think, in terms of, aside from getting column inches, that politicians get endorsements from, you know, from people that attract different types of voters?
I think it's it appears to be important in the US, but it's not important in the UK. In fact, it's often proved to be counterproductive in the UK, where entertainers, celebrities have the mickey taken out of them for thinking they, quote, know about politics. One thinks of Sean Connery, who tried to intervene in the Scottish referendum debate, was lampooned.
Because he doesn't live in Scotland.
One of them, indeed, and lives in a place where he pays less tax than he would if he lived in Scotland, but we won't go there. Well, he's gone there. but in America, it does seem to play, and I think it goes back to the nature of American politics, the razzmatazz, the non-ideological nature of American politics lends itself much more to celebrity endorsement. People identify with celebrities, and if they think this part is okay, then I do. But it's not a universal phenomenon, so just to answer your question, celebrity endorsement is relevant, and I don't know in Latin America, I'd be interested in what Oscar has to say. It's not relevant in most of Europe that I'm familiar with, but it is relevant in the US.
It isn't relevant in Latin America. Latin American politics tend to look much more like European politics. But even, you know, having lived in the US for a long while, I would say that the importance of celebrity endorsement is quite relative. It can be very damaging. I mean, if you look into the things that 50 Cent was saying, quite a few of them are very problematic. She was praising Hillary for not having looked into his husband's...
Stand by your man, I think, exactly. Is the phrase that comes to mind.
And then he says... As we saw last time around with Barack Obama when he was endorsed by the rapper Ludacris, it was... Yeah, there was then Ludicrous. Lots of Republicans saying, "Oh, well, if you look at his lyrics and this is what he said about Hillary, you know, it can come back to bite you."
Absolutely, and it would be very, very difficult for the feminist side of Hillary's followers to look at 50 Cent's endorsement and say, "Oh, that's all right." Then, if our husband cheats us, then we just look the other way, and that's true love.
The other problem that Hillary might have is 50 Cent's, given the last election, he's going to back Hillary until another candidate comes along who might attract him more, which is what happened last time.
Michelle Obama, apparently.
Well, there we are. We'll take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, and my guests, Ivor Gaber and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. We're back in a moment.
It's full steam ahead with the new transport-themed issue of Monocle that includes our survey of the best in class from cars to trams, planes to trains. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In the affairs section, we take to the subsidised skies in Montana, Queensland and Wales to find out why small airlines need big backing.
In this month's business section, we take up the transport theme with a visit to the small Japanese city of Kanazawa, put on the business and tourist map by the new Hokuriku Shinkansen, which began service in March.
In culture, we tackle transport by looking at Art Movers, the unsung multi-billion dollar arm of the art world.
The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to sign up now.
The Big Interview is Monocle 24's bold new series featuring in-depth interviews with inspirational names in global politics, business, culture, and design.
For me, the worst thing is the client says, "Oh, well, do whatever." I think, what the hell? Then I'd be an artist. Then why should you pay me to do whatever? There is a job here to do.
Hosted by our senior editors, it brings you unique, illuminating one-on-one discussions with fascinating characters as we find out what makes them tick.
In those moments when I am looking death in the eye, I ask myself repeatedly, why can I not turn away from this story? And I just kept going back to Iraq, to Afghanistan, at the expense of my life.
With insights into some of the sharpest minds shaping their fields today, it's a show you wouldn't want to miss. So tune in every Sunday at 9 a.m. London time for The Big Interview, right here on Monocle 24.
Yeah. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 18:19 in London, 13:19 in New York. My guests today, Ivor Gaber and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, it almost seems like barely a week goes by where the Middle East doesn't lose another priceless symbol of its history. The city of Palmyra has now fallen to the hands of ISIS militants, with the group in control of the nearby airport. The city is also within close proximity to oil and gas fields, crucial to Syria's western population. No damage has been reported to Palmyra's historical artifacts just yet, although past indications suggest the so-called Islamic State isn't likely to view the pre-Islam monuments with much fondness. Ivor Gaber, are we putting too much emphasis here on the heritage of Palmyra, ignoring the plight of the citizens that actually live there?
Well, that's, you make a very strong point there, but I wouldn't want to say it's an either-or. I mean, we should be caring about both. And as much as I condemn, as I do with every ounce I can, the destruction and defacement of these archaeological heritages, it's not the first time world history has seen images being attacked by people who regard them as symbols. I mean, we go right back to biblical times where idols were being smashed every which way you looked. We look at the history of the British Civil War, prior to that, the Reformation, when the great hero of Wolfe Hall sent in soldiers to deface Catholic churches and smash, etc., etc. And it goes right through history, so it's always a symbol. I suppose the issue today is because of new media or old media, whatever, television and YouTube and so forth, we're much more aware of it. There have been churches, synagogues, mosques destroyed throughout history. We're now seeing it live, so to speak. But I'm desperately sad every time. I started the most vivid image of the destruction of the giant statues in Afghanistan by the Taliban when they were pulled down. Mm. That was the start of it, if you like, in the modern era.
In 2002. Yeah,
And it was a moment of a great sadness to me. I represent the UK at a number of UNESCO media committees, and I know it's something that really UNESCO feels so impotent about. It's so impotent.
I was going to use that word, impotent, Oscar, because watching this, that is kind of how I feel. And UNESCO, as Ivor mentions there, might want to do something, but so far there's been a hashtag for Unite for Palmyra. I mean, yeah, no one's going in to help, you know, save this archaeology, let alone the people.
Well, I read in social media that the Syrian government did manage to transport some of the statues outside of Palmyra. But as Ivor was suggesting, this story matters because history tells us that iconoclasticism, the destruction of valuable objects, more often than not, is the preface of a genocide. And as the story tells us, this particular city is very close to oil and gas deposits, which are crucial to the survival of the people in Western Syria. So what we are witnessing here is something very dangerous and very problematic, both in cultural terms and geopolitical terms. Mind you, I would like to know, where are they getting those hammers and the things they are using to destroy them? Because the other story that is doing the rounds in the media tells us that a lot of the weaponry and tools of destruction that are being used by IS may be ours.
Ivor, Oscar just mentioned there about what the Syrian government may or may not have been able to do to help rescue some of this equipment, some of these sites. And here's the problem, isn't it? Because whose side are we on in this fight? It's, if the West did want to be trying to fight ISIS in Syria, it's not going to do it alongside the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad, is it?
I don't know. I mean,
nobody knows.
it is the most confusing international conflict I have ever known. Maybe confusing is the wrong word, but most problematic, because the side that the West finds most favourable, the secular Free Syrian opposition, is the side that is by every day becoming less and less relevant, less and less significant. We have got a real odd mix, haven't we, that Israelis, for example, have an interest in working alongside Iranians to combat ISIS, and yet the idea of Israelis and Iranians collaborating would seem far-fetched. I think the West has got an unenviable position, partly because of our ill-conceived interventions over the last 20 years into Iraq and Afghanistan, or certainly Iraq, has obviously is a major cause. Western intervention has not proved a great success, and of course Libya is another example where. So, you know, I would, if I were advising a Western government, I would say to them exactly what I'm saying to you, Steve, is I don't know what to do.
Oscar, can you do any better than I don't know what to do?
Well, I think we know what needs to be done. It's just that it sounds unpalatable. It seems unpalatable, as I will put it. My suggestion is indeed that we need to work with the people that some of our governments would not like to work with. So, for instance, we need to work with the Russians here, so as to make sure that some pressure can be put on those on the ground. And yes, we will. This is a problem, at least to a certain extent, of our own making. And we will find ourselves in bed with those we were fighting against before.
Can I just
certain
do,
of it?
Can I just? Well, more than happy to blame the UK when I think the UK is to blame. But in what sense is Syria of our own making?
At least to a certain extent, it is a problem of our own making, in the sense that the intervention and the weaponry that was supposedly going only to moderate forces on the ground ended up in the hands of everybody else. As you yourself put it, those moderates are less and less relevant. It might be the case that they were irrelevant from the very start. And there are many indications that we ended up helping some of these undesirables who are now
possible,
gaining ground.
Although my understanding was we were not supplying weapons per se. More relevant, I would have
well,
thought.
Well, there were overt and covert operations, okay, of course.
I accept that. But, I mean, one has to look back to what most of us welcome, the Arab Spring, was the linchpin for all of this.
That's and also the case. Yes.
I find it very difficult as somebody who's self-critical, if you like, to say, where did I go wrong? What happened to the, you know, what could have been done to have made the Arab Spring, with the exception of Tunisia, have a better outcome?
Well, just on that note, Oscar, and looking at the situation in Syria, when those first peaceful uprisings against Bashar al-Assad began, what should the West have done or not done?
Well, clearly not intervening in military terms, not sending advisors, not sending weapons. That has always
But many people would have said that then all opposition groups would have been crushed by Assad.
That may be the case. Of course, we're dealing here with purely speculative matters. But if a revolution and a popular rebellion does have to gain a tract on its own, at least at the beginning. Otherwise, it faces the problematic situation of becoming dependent on others. And that may have happened in the case of Syria. Of course, the case of Libya is even more.
Let's leave aside Libya for now. I just want to stick on Syria for a moment. And in fact, in the role of ISIS as well. So let's look at what ISIS did with in Iraq. We all saw what happened a year ago with the Yazidis, 40,000 people on a mountain. They were going to be killed or starved, you know, and the world said, we must do something about this. We must send people in to help them. Is the problem then that it's not, everyone doesn't just bugger off straight after?
Well, I think humanitarian intervention in a very limited sense can help. And rescuing the Yazidis, you scoff, Oscar, but I think rescuing the Yazidis was an important thing to do.
Look, humanitarian intervention has, you know, if you ask General Jackson, I'm not saying some radical, but General Jackson, the former Chief of Staff of the UK Army, he'll tell you that pretty much the only two cases of good humanitarian interventions would have been Rwanda and or Syria.
But let's not ask General Jackson, let's ask you right now, those 40,000 Yazidis on a mountain, what would you have done?
Well, of course, it is the case that in situations like those, we can and do find ways to intervene, not militarily, not necessarily militarily. But again, what is important to this to save those 40,000? But what is also important to this question is to ask ourselves what kind of alliances we made in the region. It is very, very crucial to this particular point, the fact that by making alliances with Saudi Arabia, by not putting more pressure on them, by not containing Salafism and the money behind Salafism, that became an important cause for the rise of ISIS in Syria.
I just don't agree that humanitarian intervention never works. I just think in the UK context, the intervention in Sierra Leone worked. The intervention in Bosnia
worked. Sierra Leone, Rwanda, and those are the only examples we have.
Okay, at least we found some agreement right at the end there. Ivor Gaber and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. The programme was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sarah Manetta. The studio manager was Sean Malervi. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.